Thanks for listening to the Frontiers podcast. If you have a moment before we start, please rate and follow this podcast. It makes a huge difference. The more of you that do this, the more people get to listen. And the more people that get to listen, the bigger platform I'm building for academics to share their research. Thanks so much. Hi there, you're listening to Frontiers, the podcast that explores cutting-edge research from the world's best scientists. I'm Ian Hallett, and here's what's coming up today. It sounds like we're getting closer to treatments that cure cancer.
It's not like that we will develop a cure for cancer, a single drug we're given, it wipes out your cancer. It's going to be incremental progress. You'll live with it, but you won't die of it. Nobody ever likes to say that we'll find a cure for cancer, but then again, nobody ever said we'd get to the moon.
What can people do to reduce their risks of cancer?
Don't smoke, don't smoke, don't smoke.
That was Professor Andrew Beggs of the Institute of Cancer and Genomic Scientists at the University of Birmingham. Professor Beggs is a world-leading expert in cancer genetics, and I organised this conversation around two main topics. So the first one is trying to answer why is cancer so hard and often intrusive to treat. He explained that question in very clear terms and gave us some ideas about what types of treatments might be available to all of us in the future. I then asked what individual actions we can all take to minimise our own personal risk of cancer. And again, hugely educational, informative, valuable advice from a world expert in this area. It is probably one of the most important conversations I've had in my life, leave alone this podcast. The information that I gained from it was genuinely valuable and things that I will take forward in my life, for my family, for my friends. So please enjoy, and I hope you get value from this conversation with Professor Andrew Beggs. Professor Beggs, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
It would be great to understand a little bit about your career journey and your research interest before we delve into what will be, I'm sure, a very interesting and insightful topic. So could you just give us your story for a couple of minutes? It would be great to hear that.
Thanks for asking. It is a bit unusual because usually most people in my situation, clinical academics, have a not a straightforward pathway to where they've ended up. So I started off, went to medical school, as hopefully you have to become a doctor. And at medical school, I did some science at that stage. You have the opportunity to do a Bachelor of Science degree in the middle of your medical degree. And so I did one in medical physics and started on a technique called positron emission tomography. And that sort of fired my interest for research at an early stage. We found that you could see how malignant a tumor was by how much radiation it gave off with this PET scanning technique. And I was really lucky. I had a really great supervisor at that stage who encouraged me to publish for academic papers, encouraged me to get into research. And from that, I ended up publishing quite a few papers, which was unusual for a medical student at that time. I then went off and became a surgeon because that's what I wanted to do. And it was all going swimmingly well until about 2006, 2007, when they changed the way that medical training in the United Kingdom worked. And they changed the way that you apply for jobs as a junior doctor. And at that stage, I thought, well, I've done all right. I seem to be doing academically wise. I'll apply for a job to get to the next stage in training. And unfortunately, I didn't get shortlisted at all. It was what was known as the MTAS system. And it was a system which was very controversial at the time. And I couldn't get a job. And obviously, this was a bit upsetting, devastating to me that I couldn't get training. And my wife, who always seems to find these jobs for me, was looking in the back of the British Medical Journal and said, oh, there's a job as a research fellow here. Why don't you apply for that? I know you like research. So I applied, and it was in Croydon at the end. And I did not really know. I was living in London at the time. I didn't know anything about Croydon. And ended up working in the hospital in Croydon. And I would do a bit of clinical, but I met my two PhD supervisors there who worked with my clinical supervisor. One of them was a guy called Ian Tomlinson, who has discovered or participated in the discovery of most of the genes that cause bowel cancer. We passed down, which was one of the people whose work I did the lab in. And the other lady was called Shirley Hodgson, who was also a professor of cancer genetics. And so I fell into it almost by accident, as a lot of people do say, you sort of fall into these things by accident. And did my PhD in his lab. Initially, we started at the Cancer Research UK building in central London in Lincoln Inn Fields. And we moved out to Oxford about a year into my PhD. And being in both those environments, what was the one in London has now turned to what's called the Crick Institute in London, which is an amazing building. But also moving to Oxford really gave me the passion for academic research. And I finished my PhD with Ian and Shirley. And in the end, once again, couldn't get a job in London. Nobody wanted a job as an academic surgeon who was interested in cancer genetics in London. So I ended up, once again, looking in the back of the BMJ. And my wife went, oh, look, there's a job in Birmingham as an academic in Birmingham. Perhaps you should apply for that. So I applied for that and ended up working for a chap called Dion Morton, who's quite a prominent surgeon who's interested in cancer genetics as well. And that's where it all sort of really took off. I ended up getting a series of what we would use in academic world fellowships, which are competitively awarded money by research charities or research funders to make your work go forwards. And one of the first ones was the Wellcome Trust funded me, and then Cancer Research UK funded me, and now the Medical Research Council funded me. And from that, I developed my research program into cancer genetics, in bowel cancer and other cancers. And I've been in Birmingham now since about 2012.
That's inspirational. So we have quite a lot of younger listeners for on this podcast. And if there's ever a story about unmanaged but managed career journey, that's a great one. So thank you so much for sharing that. So cancer genetics, could you just explain what cancer genetics is?
Yeah, the easiest way to describe it is in the form of a computer. So what people don't always appreciate is your cells have genetic code. And that genetic code is like a computer program that tells what the cells to do, what to do. And in your cells, one of the ways, the main way in which cancer occurs is when those instructions go wrong. Because those instructions tell a cell how to grow, how to divide, where to move to, what to make. And cancer occurs when those instructions go wrong, they get corrupted. Because as a cell gets copied, it's a very accurate process, but the human genome is 3 billion letters long. And as it copies it, it will make errors. And there are mechanisms in place in a cell to make errors better, to get rid of them. But unfortunately, when cancer happens, this is when the errors aren't corrected and the cell grows in a dysfunctional way. And that's what cancer is, essentially. And cancer genetics is to study those changes that cause the errors not to be repaired and what they have on downstream effects on the cell, and also in the effects that it has on the human body.
Very clear. Thank you. Now, I did a poll before this conversation with the listeners and asked them what I should ask you. And it was really interesting, actually. I gave a number of different options, but the two most popular by far, and they were equally popular, were around why is it so difficult to treat cancer and how are we progressing in our treatment technology and different therapies that might be available on offer, and what actions can individuals take to mitigate their risk of developing cancer. So one of the promises I made to the people that filled out that poll is I would concentrate as much as I could on this of this conversation on those two important topics. But we started to touch on the kind of the background to it just now when I asked you to explain what cancer genetics are. But it'd be great to spend a few minutes just explaining cancer. So what is it? How does it happen? Is it inherited, lifestyle-driven, environmental-driven? It'd be great just to get a rounded understanding of what it is and how it occurs and why it occurs.
Okay, well, that's a great question, because cancer is a scary thing. Everybody thinks I don't want cancer, but they don't always understand where it comes from. I think the easiest way to understand cancer is the ultimate disease of evolution in cells. So as I explained to you just earlier, cancer happens when cells go wrong, where the instructions go wrong. But once they go wrong, the cell wants to survive. And cancer happens as a consequence of the cancer cell trying to survive the mutations it's gathered to propagate itself in the body, despite the treatments you give it. So most cancer, I'm afraid to tell your listeners, happens because of nothing you've done wrong. It just happens spontaneously because of failure of your body to repair the cells that are faulty. And so there are things that can change that. So we talked about lifestyle factors. So the reason why smoking is so deadly and causes so many cancers is that it damages the DNA directly of cells and makes it worse. So imagine your cell is busily trying to repair itself, you're smoking, and you make it worse by damaging the DNA more. More cells mutate and the cancer is more likely to progress, because cancer is not a one-step process. For instance, you don't just smoke and get a mutation in your DNA in the cells and then that's it. If you keep smoking, you'll accelerate the progression of the cell through cancer. There are inherited forms. So there are quite a few inherited cancer syndromes. We know more and more about them every day. The most common ones that people will know about is one called BRCA mutations. So that's the one that Angelina Jolie has that she had a risk-reducing mastectomy for. And that is the gene genetic. That's where you have you carry the mutations throughout your entire body of a gene called BRCA1 and BRCA2, and they fail to repair DNA properly. And so it makes you vulnerable to certain types of cancer. If you're a woman, breast cancer. If you're a man, prostate cancer, interestingly. But it's not that common, although within breast cancer sufferers, it's about 1 in 10. There's another condition called Lynch syndrome, which is very common as well, but not many people have heard of because it's sort of a hidden disease. It tends to cause bowel cancer, and people don't want to talk about bowels. And it can lead to multiple cancers throughout the body at a young age. But they're relatively rare. Only about 5 to 10% of cancers are caused by inherited factors. Lifestyle, apart from smoking, other things can cause problems. But everybody's always worried, oh, no, if I change my lifestyle, I won't get cancer. And they are all little things that add up. So, for instance, if you ate red meat every day, yes, your risk of cancer will go up by a small amount, but it won't kill you, unlike smoking. UV and UV radiation that causes melanoma, skin cancer, if you expose yourself once a week or once every couple of weeks, it's unlikely to put your skin cancer risk up much, but it can put it up a lot if you're genetically vulnerable. So some people have a genetic vulnerability to skin cancer. So cancer is this sort of complex interplay of the cell going wrong, but then you've got all the other risk factors of not repairing the DNA properly because you've got inherited mutation, the lifestyle factors because you're smoking or you expose yourself to UV. And some people we know carry genetic change that makes them, there are only very small risks of increasing cancer, but they make the cancer more likely to happen. The ones I've told you about before, like Lynch syndrome and BRCA, you've got about a 50 to 100% risk of cancer in your life. These other genetic changes, and they're called SNPs, will increase your risk by a small amount, 1 or 2% per year. If you carry a lot of these changes, which are common in all of us, your risk of cancer could be up to 10 or 15% greater than the rest of the population.
So should we be paying attention to to whether close relatives, parents, grandparents, siblings, uncles, aunts, great uncles, great aunts, whether they have developed different forms of cancer during their lives? Is that an important signal for ourselves?
Yeah, it's a really important signal. So I do clinical work as well as a work in the laboratory. And one of the most, it's not frustrating, but upsetting things is when you hear somebody who says, oh yeah, my dad had cancer, my uncle had cancer, my sister's got cancer, but I thought we were just unlucky. And if you've got a strong family history, it's almost certain you're carrying something that's going to make your risk of cancer higher. And we see people in clinic. The easiest rule we use is what's called the 3-2-1 rule. So three relatives with cancer, two of whom are first degree relatives to each other. So say your mum and you, and one of whom who developed cancer less than 55. And that makes it much stronger, the likelihood that you will have an inherited form of cancer. And so always be watch out for your family history. And NHS England is actually advising people to look out for this. Also, if you're from certain ethnic groups as well, you will carry a higher risk of cancer potentially. So if you're from the Ashkenazi Jewish population, there's a higher risk of a BRCA mutation in that population. And in fact, some of the Jewish welfare charities and NHS England are doing a testing program for Jewish families from the Ashkenazi community who may carry a BRCA mutation so we can get it before they actually develop cancer.
I think we're going to go into a conversation that I was intending to have a bit later on, but it seems relevant to do that now. So as an individual, let's say I have a family history of cancer, and now I've listened to this conversation, I've made the connection, which I have to admit, I'm not sure how many people necessarily do make that strong connection about family history and their own likelihood or propensity to develop this. How would I get if I'm someone in my 20s or my 30s or my 40s, and I know I've got some people in my family that have developed different forms of cancer, how would I know or assess my own personal risk? Is there blood tests that can be done? Are there other things that can be done? Or shouldn't I do that? Should I just continue living my life and enjoying my life? I mean, part of that's a moral question, but it would be great to get your perspective on that.
Well, interestingly, ethics and this kind of debate does come a lot in genetic testing. Now, if you've got a really strong family history, hopefully you've already been picked up by the NHS. But if you haven't, your GP can refer you for a family assessment. Every NHS organisation will have access to a genetic testing service, so genetic counsellors, consultant geneticists. And they will ask you to fill out, if your GP refers you in, they will ask you to fill out a family history form. And they can assess from that whether you might qualify for genetic testing based on your family history, the age of onset of the cancers, and other factors. However, there are genetic testing companies out there that offer genetic testing for you direct to consumer. Now, they're a bit of an unregulated Wild West, some of them. Some of them are very good and will offer you a good test and good. And they're usually the ones that offer genetic counseling as well at the same time. So they'll say, yeah, we'll test you, but you have to speak to one of our genetic counselors first. Some of them who just say, oh, just send us a saliva sample and we'll tell you, they're not probably not the ones to use. Because one of the issues as well, there's a lot of, you can have a look at just one gene, say BRCA, but some companies will offer your whole genome sequenced. And that can offer a lot of information, but it can open a Pandora's box if you're not appropriately counseled or you have the training. So for instance, yes, it may find you have a BRCA mutation, but it may find something you weren't expecting. Like there is an inherited form of Alzheimer's called an APOE mutation. If you have the APOE4 gene, your risk of Alzheimer's quadruples. And that's quite a thing to take in if you were expecting only one test result. And so although these direct testing companies do exist, and I wouldn't not advise people to use them, it's like anything, you need to be very careful about what you select.
Okay. And there's also some organizations, and these are emerging now, that are offering like annual MRI scans to see whether there's anything that can be detected there. Again, is incredibly expensive. I'm assuming that over time it will become more accessible and cheaper to hopefully everyday people, maybe not. But is that worthwhile doing? I've spoken to other people that said, where you're going to find, if you do an MRI scan, you're going to find a problem. The question is, do you want to accept that problem and deal with it or not?
Well, the medical term we use for it is incidentaloma, i.e. it's incidentally found. And yes, you will. I mean, interestingly, commonly when we do scans for other reasons, we will usually find something else we have to investigate. However, one of the ways of looking at it, especially in the UK, is that we have good screening programs for a lot of cancers already. So breast cancer has the breast screening program with mammography. Colorectal cancer has the FIT testing, the poo sticks, as people call it. And the NHS is a very efficient organization, despite what it seems like, and they wouldn't offer it unless it worked. And at the moment, one of the criteria for screening has to be cheap and widely available. And so an MRI scan, which may cost you hundreds of pounds and not show anything, is not really the most cost-effective way of doing it. It may show something up, but you get a bit of confirmation bias then, saying, well, my friend's MRI scan showed that he had a cancer and it got him 5 years earlier. A good example is with prostate cancer. We pick up a lot of incidental prostate cancers on whole body MRI scans. And people like to say, oh, well, you know, I found my prostate cancer, you know, it saved my life. But that prostate cancer may never have killed you. That's the other thing. There was a very famous study where they did autopsies on, I think it was 10 or 20 men, after obviously, they died for other reasons. And when they looked at them, they instantly found that 80% of the men had little prostate cancer. But it never harmed and never caused any problems. And we know a lot of cancers come and go. So you may never know you have cancer. Your body may almost fight it off and disappear. It's what we struggle with screening is finding the ones that are bad. So for instance, if you've had a prostate cancer, found an MRI scan and you have your prostate out, that can cause significant complications. You can have problems with the surgery. You can have problems with your life afterwards, passing water, other problems. And the issue with that is, was it worth detecting it in the first place? Now, I know that sounds very patronizing to some people who are terrified of cancer. But on the other hand, it's a risk versus benefits. Are you willing to live with the findings you may find on your scan or your genetic test versus the operations or tests you may have to investigate the cancer further, which carry their own risks?
Yes, interesting, because if you don't know, then you don't act. And if you do know, then you almost feel like you have a duty to act, even if you don't need to. So you have this really difficult... And presumably, what's the medical stance on these things? So from a patient's perspective, I imagine that they want to do the best for their own longevity and their own health. But from a medical stance perspective, if you find something by accident as a result of some other procedure that was happening, what is the position? Are you compelled to investigate it?
We can't ignore it. And then you can end up going down the line. A really good example is King Charles now and his diagnosis of cancer. So nobody knows what happened because they kept it, but you can sort of gather from the news in that he went in for a routine benign prostate procedure. And while he was there, they found something else. They said cancer, but we don't know where it is or what it is, but they found something else. And that's an example of exactly where screening can happen. You have to be willing to treat the other problem. And it can be it's very difficult as well for patients. If you say, well, you've got cancer, we found it incidentally, they're going to go, but we don't think it's going to kill you and you can probably leave it. Nobody's really going to want to go for that. And so, you know, this is the issue we have. Can the system catch up with the cancers that we're going to discover through screening, which may not have ever caused you any harm in the first place.
That's interesting. I think one of the problems here is that, and this is always, you always hear the extremes. So you hear of the 45-year-old with three young children that was absolutely fine and then suddenly started getting headaches and ended up with a late stage cancer and given 6 months to live. You hear stories like that. Now, I think that increases the kind of the fear of doing nothing or the fear of not doing your own tests and those types of things. So it'd be great to unpack that circumstance, because they're the stories that we hear about on a everyday basis. You hear about the friend of a friend that had this situation. I'm assuming that's not very common, and I'm assuming that that people shouldn't react to those types of things. But again, it'd be great to understand a little bit more about those circumstances, so how you can go from feeling nothing to feeling something and then being given 6 months to live.
From my perspective, I run a young onset cancer clinic anyway for people who with bowel cancer are diagnosed at a young age. So I see a lot of them, but it is, in the overall scheme of things in the population, it is unusual, but it's terrifying when you hear about it on a more human stance, emotional stance. It's terrifying when you hear about a friend of yours who's died of cancer at the age of 45. Now, one interesting thing about bowel cancer, for instance, which is my main cancer of interest, is we are seeing people getting it younger. We don't know why. There is an element of genetic susceptibility that's not been detected up to this point, i.e. we are finding people who actually have an inherited form of cancer earlier. But on the other hand, especially cancer of the back passage of the rectum, we're seeing more and more younger onset cases. And it's not just in the UK, it's everywhere. And we don't know why. And it can be very difficult to say to somebody who's got what would be very mild symptoms, who could present to a GP or to me, you know, we're not going to do any tests. I don't think there's much going on. We're going to do something limited. They want everything to be done because they've heard about that situation you've talked about in the mid-40s patient who has got a horrible metastatic cancer. They are thankfully rare. I mean, one of the things that's changing is the way we treat them. In the past, they would probably have just died within 2 or 3 months, which is really sad. But now we have better treatments. There are some people we prolong their life for quite a long time. Some people we even cure now. And so, although it's not ideal when you're in that terrifying situation, the frequency of it is so low that it sounds very patronizing and paternal to say, don't worry about it. But honestly, don't worry about it.
Yes, interesting. So you mentioned treatment. Let's go on to treatment now. Again, I think this is driven by everybody's kind of personal experience of a relative or a friend that's been through this. But it seems from the outside incredibly hard to treat and often very intrusive to treat as well. Why is that?
There's a couple of reasons. One, I suppose the major one is where the tumor is. And most tumors are happening quite deep in the body. And if you're, there are three major ways really to treat cancer: surgery, chemotherapy, radiotherapy. And they've all got advantages and disadvantages. Interestingly, in my own cancer, bowel cancer, surgery still cures more people than bowel cancer. Sorry, in bowel cancer than radiotherapy or chemotherapy. However, it is invasive. You have to have a cut, you have to be in hospital, you could end up with a temporary stoma bag. So that brings us to the chemotherapy and radiotherapy with other cancers. Now, the way we kill cancer with chemotherapy, people probably wonder, how does chemotherapy even work? So the really basic definition is chemotherapy is a drug that kills the cancer cells faster than your own cells, which I know sounds horrific, but it's essentially a poison that's targeted towards cancer cells, old-fashioned types of chemotherapy. And so that's why you have so many side effects with chemotherapy, because it's killing some of your normal cells as well and making you feel ill. The vomiting, the hair loss, the skin rashes, all the other symptoms you have, the blood problems are all related to the fact it also damages normal cells. And so we need to get better. Well, we are getting better at making more targeted chemotherapy. So the most revolutionary drug of the last 20 years, and the guy who discovered it won a Nobel Prize for it, is something called immunotherapy. There's a molecule on the surface of cancer cells called PD-1. PDL1. It's like a flag that tells the immune system not to attack the tumor. It can recognize it as foreign, but the way the tumor escapes, we talked about evolution before, the way it escapes from the immune system is by putting this flag called PD-1 on the surface of it. And these class of drugs, this Japanese scientist discovered the molecule PD-1, and he also invented a class of inhibitors that bind to it and make the immune system see it. Now, really interestingly, it doesn't work in all cancers. It works in subsets of cancer. So in bowel cancer, it works in about 20% of bowel cancer. But in those bowel cancers, the tumor is almost entirely wiped out, as in it just disappears. And I've had some patients who come to our clinic with this, and others have at other hospitals, where they've had really advanced bowel cancer and they've had this flag on the surface, shows they're sensitive to it. We've given them the PD-1 inhibitor, and it's wiped the cancer out completely and with minimal side effects as well, because you're using the body's own immune system just against the cancer rather than the whole thing. And so that's where we're heading towards, less invasive therapies that are less toxic and make people feel not like the old days when they're having horrible chemotherapy, all the side effects. The final one's radiotherapy. And now radiotherapy actually has not as many side effects as chemotherapy and can be highly effective in some cases. So prostate cancer gets treated by radiotherapy and can be curative. Bowel cancer, back passage cancer specifically, gets treated by radiotherapy. And if you took 100 bowel cancers and you just give them radiotherapy, a big strong dose of radiotherapy, about 10 or 15% of them will disappear completely. And there are research studies going on at the moment to identify those tumors before. So we can just say to the patient, well, you'll just have radiotherapy, your cancer will go on, we can just watch you, and we won't need any invasive surgery. So we are making strides in making these treatments less toxic. Because at the moment, some of the other ones, like blood cancers, for instance, are the chemotherapy we give for that is enormously toxic. There is one other advance I'll mention, and that's where we take T cells out of the patient and we reprogram them to attack the cancer. It's called CAR T cells, because with the receptor on the T cells, we reprogram to attack. And that's had some really dramatic successes. There have been some children with end-stage leukemia who've had reprogrammed CAR T cells. And once again, it's just wiped the tumor out. It's gone. And that's minimally toxic as well, the treatment. The only issue is that you have to destroy all of their bone marrow with chemotherapy before you give the CAR T cells and then give them a stem cell transplant. So it's still quite toxic, but it works for patients who've had no other option in the past.
So these treatments that seem to have these amazing outcomes where the cancer disappears, are they widely available and do they work? I mean, what's their success rate?
Yeah, so are they widely available? It depends on the cancer type. It depends whether you, at the moment, more globally, it depends on your access to funding. So they're not cheap. Every dose of a PD-1 inhibitor, at least in the UK, is about £1,000. And so, although they're very widely available, they're not covered by all healthcare systems. And so in the NHS, I'm sorry to use the model of the NHS time, but it's the one I know. In the NHS, it's available for certain cancers, but it's not always available as what we call the first line treatment. So the first thing you'd have up front, because the evidence isn't just there. Yeah, because the research studies are happening at the moment. And then we have to apply to NICE, which is the National Institute for Care Excellence and Clinical Excellence, to get the drug approved. And the Cancer Drugs Fund does that as well. But the issue is there are tumors that are out there that we don't always give it to in first line because the evidence hasn't caught up with the science yet, the clinical evidence. It's probably going to be far cheaper to give that drug, wipe it out, than offer these patients old-fashioned chemotherapy and surgery. But we've not really caught up with that yet. CAR T cells, amazingly, the NHS does fund that, or again, because they are so effective in some patients. They cost £250,000 for a single dose. However, they are so effective, the benefit of giving them to a patient far outweighs any treatment that they could have alternately and all the complications that ensue for that. And for radiotherapy, yeah, I mean, what we talked about, the radiotherapy and the bowel cancer, yeah, I mean, that's widely available everywhere. And the evidence is changing for that, in that we're thinking now, well, if they have such a dramatic response, their cancer disappears after the treatment, perhaps we can just watch and wait them. And now we have the evidence, that's probably going to be the right thing to do. So it's more about generating the evidence. We know the science. We've got good evidence at the early stage that these treatments all work, but we need to demonstrate it in bigger randomized trials.
So I'm going to ask a question later about why these things cost so much money. We'll cover that in a second. So if somebody has cancer diagnosed today in the UK, would they have the option to access these therapies, these options, or would they still have a route where there's surgery and chemotherapy as the primary mechanism? What I'm trying to understand is the weighting between the different treatments. If you've got these new kind of breakthrough treatments that I have to confess I hadn't heard of, but I am aware of people within the last couple of years that have been had dramatic surgical procedures to remove cancer from their bodies. So how prevalent are these? So if they're accessible, great, fantastic. But how prevalent are they? How utilized are they compared to some of the other more difficult to receive treatments?
Unfortunately, it's like anything. It depends who you talk to. And there are really good oncologists and surgeons at tiny hospitals who give access to these treatments. And there are people who are not so aware of these treatments in big hospitals who don't put people into them. So it's a bit of a knowledge and education. They are approved, so you should be able to get access to them. But because clinical practice is catching up, you may not, your clinician may not always know about them in the same way that you may do at some hospitals. So part of this comes down to patient education. And usually in my experience of young people, especially with cancer, they will have done all the reading. They will say, well, I can't have this treatment. And although doctors, if you listen to this, will hate me for saying this, if you think there's a treatment you should be having that you can't get, then you should go and get a second opinion if you think it's worth it. Because we still have the situation where people are being denied these types of drugs, not because people are wrong or they are doing something bad. It's just because they don't necessarily are aware of the benefits of some of them.
This notion of a second opinion is really interesting. So I have spoken to people that have refused to go down the path of having a second opinion because they're worried about offending the person that gave them the first opinion. And they're worried about it being a challenge to their competence. How do medics perceive second and maybe third opinions in those circumstances?
I think it requires a degree of empathy, and medics are human beings like everybody else. So yeah, people may get upset if you ask for a second opinion. But on the other hand, it's you, it's important, it's your body. And I think all doctors would agree that people are entitled to a second opinion. Now, it shouldn't change what happens to you. You know, the GMC or our professional body are very clear about that. If you go for a second opinion, the doctor who treated you can't just say, well, that's it, I've had enough of you, off you go. That's not fair. So, you know, it's unlikely to happen. It's not impossible, but you shouldn't be afraid of offending your doctor if you're not happy with treatment. I get patients who come and see me and they say, Andrew, I'm not completely convinced you're right. Can I see somebody else? And I'll say, yeah, sure. You can see my colleague in the hospital. If you want a different hospital, here's somebody else, another hospital who knows an expert in this tumor. Why don't you go and have a chat to them and see what you think? And actually, our end goal for most doctors is for them to be cured of cancer. You know, we don't really care how it happens. We just want it to happen. And so from my point of view, I'm not bothered about people having a second opinion. I think it's a good thing. People shouldn't be afraid of asking for it.
That's great to hear. Thank you. So I was going to ask you, why don't we have a cure yet? But it sounds like from some of your earlier answers that we're getting closer to treatments that do cure cancer.
I think one of the things we don't celebrate enough is that if you look at 50 years ago and where we are now, what the difference is. So if you're a man with testicular cancer, the cure rate is close to 100% these days. And that's, you know, mind-boggling. If most children, 90% of children with cancer will survive and be cured. You know, so there are tumors, we are already there. I mean, to turn it on its head, the other one to look at is cervical cancer. Cervical cancer, terrible. Jay Goody died from it. You know, it was a terrible cancer. Now we've introduced the HPV vaccine, which is technically a cancer treatment because we're stopping people from getting the human papillomavirus. The rates of cervical cancer have plummeted. They're just gone. So that's a cure. So I think we don't always think, we only ever hear about the bad cases. And the rates of cure for cancer are going up and up and up all the time. And so it's not like that we will develop a cure for cancer, a single drug we're given, it wipes out your cancer. It's going to be incremental progress. We're going to get, if everybody type of cancer individual, we're going to develop new treatments that are individually better and get you to the stage like we have with testicular cancer and with children's cancer, which wipe it out. So we are getting there. It's just, it's like a marathon. The last bit is almost the most tricky. I do think cancer will be a chronic disease in 50 years, and we'll just look at it and we'll be like diabetes and HIV. I actually need to take this tablet the rest of my life and it will stop the cancer.
Wow. That would be awesome. So why do some of these treatments cost so much money?
Well, there's drug development is a complicated business. And I work with drug companies, and the actual making the drug, when you design and develop it, from the start of the idea, we're going to target a drug against X, it can cost up to £1 billion, several billion pounds to take it from making. Because when you design a new target, a drug against a target, you have to make about 50 or 60 different iterations of the drug to find the one that works the best with the least toxicity. So that's stage one. Then stage two, and that's just all in preclinical models and cells and things like that. And then stage two, you have to, we still unfortunately have to do it against animal models. You have to take it to animal models to make sure it's not that it'll cure things, but not that toxic. And then you have to go through phase one trials, which is where you give it to volunteers who are willing to take the risk of a deadly drug, which could kill them. and which costs money, and then phase two, which is where you see whether it works, and then phase three, which is the final randomized trial where we randomize two groups of people to the drug or not. And that's a long process. It takes at the moment between 5 and 10 years, and it costs billions of dollars. So the reason these drugs are expensive is because drug companies, who are our primary developers of these, have to recoup the costs. Now, the only bits of good news is that a lot of these exciting drugs that wipe out cancer, so for instance, one of the first PDD1 inhibitors, pembrolizumab, it's called, is coming off patent soon. And so although it costs £1,000 a dose, it will actually be very, very cheap to make after that, because actually making it is very cheap. The reason it's so expensive is because the companies have to recover the cost of working it all out.
So that's the original...
The original PD-1 inhibitor, this, yeah.
So therefore the patent, because it's... They're protecting... They basically have the patent protect their research so they can recoup their investment and get some profit as a result of it. But once the patent expires, anybody can use that patent and produce the same drug at a nominal cost.
Yeah, and there's lots of drugs like that now which are coming off patent, which are game changer drugs. We always like to use the word game changer in the UK, but they really are, and they will be very cheap.
And how long would a patent last usually?
About 20 to 25 years.
Wow. So these are treatments that have been invented 20 years ago.
Yeah, and the PD-1 inhibitor is first started 20 years ago, and it's come off patent soon. And, you know, yes, it is a slightly older drug, but it'll still be highly affecting a lot of people. And they, cost has always been an issue. One of the reasons, at least in the UK environment, it's not been approved in some things is because it's very, very expensive. And there are a number of other drugs like that, which are very, very expensive and effective. And you need to cover the cost of them somehow. The CAR T cells I talked about, which are £250,000 a dose, they are recovering their cost there. The actual cost of making them is probably about £10,000 or £15,000, which is still very expensive to make compared to the other drug. I mean, making pembrolizumab, the PD-1 inhibitor, is pennies, you know, literal pennies. But the CAR T reprogramming T cells is expensive. So there will be some that come downgrade and there'll be some that won't.
Okay, very clear. So let's move on to your field, cancer genetics research. So can you just explain the process behind it and what is it in practical terms?
Well, we talked about how cancer develops. It's when the cell goes wrong. And what cancer genetics is studying those genetic changes. Now, you can either study them in the cells, the cancer cells themselves, or if the patient carries a mutation that is passed down through families, study the patient's own genetic code. And the way we do that is by analyzing the genetic sequence in the cells, DNA sequence. And so DNA was identified in the 50s, and it was the structure was done. But we didn't actually get a really good way to understand the structure, the letters in DNA, until about the 1980s when something called Sanger sequencing was invented. And there are four letters in DNA, A, C, T, and G. I better get that right, with all the geneticists listening will curse me. But from those letters, the strings of letters, and there are 3 billion in the human genome, code for all the proteins in the human genome that make up your body. And so the way we analyze them is we use a genetic sequencing machine. So I talked about Sanger sequencing, and that was a technique that you could do 600 to 700 letter spaces of DNA. But the problem with that, if you've got 3 billion letters in DNA, it would take a long time to cover the whole genome in a human body. And that's actually what they did for the Human Genome Project that others have heard about. When they made the first version of the human genome, it took them 10 years. It cost more than that, actually 15 years, and it cost them $3 billion just to sequence one human genome. But now the technology has advanced so quickly. A UK company called Celexa invented the next generation sequences, as we call them today. They've been bought by a US company called Illumina. And that has allowed all these genomic sequencing projects you hear about in the news, like the 100,000 Genomes Project. And that allows us to sequence an entire human genome in a day for about $100. That's what we're coming down to. So it's like microchips. You know, we've gone from ZX Spectrum in the 1980s to, you know, Apple's latest computer or a supercomputer all in the space of 10 or 15 years. And my laboratory looks at these genetic changes in cancer cells and in patients' bodies overall to understand how these changes affect their cancer from growing, develop, what changes. So for instance, in a cancer cell, although you need a mutated bowel cancer cell, although you need a mutation in a specific gene to be initiated called APC, there are lots of other mutations that can happen as a consequence of damage, and they accelerate the progress or they retard the progress of the cancer cell. And based on understanding those genetic changes, we can develop better treatments, and we can also identify new drug targets. And so that's what cancer genetics is.
So how do you go from identifying a change to understanding what the treatment might be? How does that process work?
The old-fashioned version used to be you would identify the genetic change and you would stick it into a mouse, because we can edit the genomes of mice now. we've always been able to an extent, but it's much more targeted now with something called CRISPR, which is basically cuts out the piece of DNA you're interested in and sticks a new bit in. And from that, you can understand the effect in the mouse. But now, I personally think justifiably, we're moving away from mouse models and we're doing it in human cellular models. So my lab develops and works on these 3D models of human cells called organoids, which is where you take a sample of a normal organ cancer and you grow them into three dimensions in a dish. And what you do is introduce the same mutation in. You see how it changes the behavior of the cell. And if you understand the biology of it, of the mutation of the gene it's in, you can say, well, I think these drug inhibitors A, B, C, and D might work against it, that we know work in other diseases. So you drop it onto the cell, you see whether it kills it. And from that, that's how the development process starts. Now, it may be it doesn't work as effectively or it's a little bit toxic, but that allows you a platform to say, well, I know this pathway that's changing the cell is the one that makes it sensitive to treatment. So I will then, now I've identified this, I will go to a drug company or I'll start an industrial partnership as a scientist saying, let's target this. And we've already done that successfully with a couple of companies where we've identified targets in bowel cancer and taken it forward into clinical trials.
So can you just explain the research community behind this? Because I'm assuming that there are thousands, hopefully hundreds of thousands of people trying to working in this field. And many of the things that they'll be doing will be similar. In many cases, might be the same. So is there sharing of research and sharing of findings as things are happening? Or is it sharing of research, sharing of findings once a finding has been made and proven? So it'd be great to understand how everybody is working together nationally and then perhaps globally in the pursuit of finding treatments and cures.
So it is competitive because scientists are like everybody else. There is competition to find the cure for cancer, you know, what we talked about earlier, the single drug. So, but we're now realizing that the whole concept of team science is important. So in bowel cancer, in sarcoma, or the cancer I treat, in children's cancers, which I work on as well, we assemble into groups within the UK, consortia of researchers who are interested in these tumor types. And we all say, well, Andrew's an expert in cancer genetics and this other person's an expert in cell models and mice. And we set objectives. We want to find a drug target for this type of cancer and work together. And that's much more common than it used to be. So it used to be that Joe Bloggs in University X would work on the same pathway as somebody in University Y and that they would compete, which is not a very efficient use of resources. And so now there will always be a bit of competition because people need to have new ideas. Because if you all go along the same way, then it can be very undiverse in terms of mechanism of curing cancer. However, we do tend to work together on a national now and on an international basis. I'm a member of a number of international consortia where we say, well, actually, scientists in Italy is very good at this thing. Or recently for me, scientists in the US is very good at this thing. Let's all work together to actually target these things as a jigsaw puzzle and come out with an answer. It's almost like a moonshot. I mean, Joe Biden has done his moonshot for cancer. And we sort of have the same thing in the UK, not quite as coordinated as the US thing, but international scientists are working closer and closer together because we're far stronger in greater numbers.
And how many people are working on this roughly? Do you know?
At least a couple hundred thousand in the world.
Hundred thousands. Wow.
Hundreds of thousands. Yeah.
Amazing. Amazing. You would hope that in time we'll find a cure.
Nobody ever likes to say that we'll find a cure for cancer. But then again, nobody ever said we'd get to the moon. Or nobody ever said we'd understand the physics of find the Higgs boson or various other physics things. And so I think we'll find a cure, if I can put it in comments, but it won't be quite what people think. It won't be just, I turn up and I take a tablet and my cancer's gone. It's going to be a lot more complicated than that. And it will be tailored to your cancer. I do think, as I said before, cancer will become a chronic disease. And we're making massive strides towards that.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. That for me was quite an interesting insight because I hadn't really thought about it in that way. Using the example, I think you said of HIV, is essentially that now.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing about HIV. I mean, 1980s, it was a death sentence. We all knew people who died of HIV and we heard about it on the news because there was no treatment. It was thought it was a terrible thing, but there was a concerted effort to develop antiretrovirals and understand the biology of HIV, which actually is quite a simple virus. And now people have a normal lifespan. So they live with HIV, but they don't die of it. And that's probably where we're going with cancer. We'll keep the cancer under control. You'll live with it, but you won't die of it.
Fantastic. Now, we covered some of the individual actions earlier. We talked about MRI scans and looking at their relatives and so on and so forth. So I just want to just finish that conversation because we deviated into different areas. So in a nutshell, what can people do to reduce their risks of cancer?
don't smoke. That's my number one. I feel, because I get asked this question all the time in clinic.
Do you?
Don't smoke, don't smoke, don't smoke. Healthy lifestyle, all these things add up in little ways. As I said, cancer is a disease which you just get, and it's modulated by lifestyle factors. So if you drink a lot of alcohol, that does increase your risk of certain types of cancers. But it doesn't mean you should stop drinking alcohol, because actually there's a sort of U-shaped curve between risk. And so drinking a small amount is not harmful. Same for exercise. If you don't do any exercise, you have a higher risk of cancer or you're obese. But once again, doing a small amount is no different from doing a large amount. Eating a healthy diet is key as well. So there's a lot of stuff in the news about ultra-processed food, but actually when it comes down to it, the risk of from ultra-processed food of cancer, for instance, is not a massive change. So it's all right to have a Big Mac, as I tell people, or something like that. Whatever you, and occasionally, as long as you're not doing it on a regular basis, the only thing, the most important thing I say is don't smoke. And if you've got a family history of cancer, identify it. Those are the lifestyle choices. One interesting thing, however, is, and this is not formal medical advice, but there are a lot of cancers where taking a daily dose of aspirin reduces the risk, bowel cancer especially. And it hasn't really been decided that's the way ahead in the UK at the moment. But in the States especially, a lot of people will take a daily dose of baby dose of aspirin, 75 milligrams, to reduce their risk of bowel cancer, strokes and polyps. And we know that's highly, in some inherited forms of bowel cancer, like Lynch syndrome, we know that reduces your risk of bowel cancer by 50%, 50. So it's quite a dramatic risk reduction. Now, the thought of mass population drugging somebody with aspirin is difficult. You know, look at what with the problems we've had with vaccines. So I don't think we're going to get close to that yet. But if you're started on aspirin by your GP, it will reduce your risk of cancer. For other things, it will reduce your risk of cancer as well.
Interesting. Interesting. What about vaping? Is there any evidence around vaping? You see a lot of people, particularly young people, doing that now.
We haven't got enough. It hasn't been around for long. You think about vaping, I mean, it was a small thing and then suddenly just took off. And so we haven't seen enough, because a lot of the evidence from these things come from population studies, you know, tracked over time. And people haven't been vaping enough to see damage. The preclinical models, one of my colleagues in the University of Birmingham actually has a research model of vaping. And you do see lung damage, but not as much. You see a different type of lung damage, not the same type of smoking. So at the moment, it looks like vaping is safer than smoking, although that's not difficult. However, we don't know how safe precisely. And one of my worries is that in 15, 20 years' time, we'll look back on the vaping craze. We'll be like, oh God, why did we do that? Because it's increased the risk of cancer. The simple answer is we don't know at the moment.
Just not enough time.
No.
Okay. So for individuals inspired by your work or the cancer research more broadly, how can they contribute or support it?
So there are the big charities like Cancer Research UK who have all the Race for Life and the fundraising and legacies in the will. The University of Birmingham, we do have an alumni and donor giving program, which you can find on Google, where you can contribute not just to cancer research, but more research more generally. And in those cases, you know the money goes directly to the researcher you're interested in funding, because there are many different types of cancer researchers that exist. So sometimes it helps to shop around and see, you know, who you're interested in, who you're interested to fund. And any amount of money makes a difference. So a lot of researchers, and I do myself, have our own Just Giving page where people can donate that way. And actually, these types of research funding are transformational. So I have big research grants from the Medical Research Council. But actually, the most profound effect I've had recently in terms of research change was from a small donation from a patient's family who were affected by onset bowel cancer. And we found a genetic change that led to a clinical trial in this group of people. So it's really quite straightforward to raise money for cancer. You just need to decide how you and when you want to target it and who you want to give it to.
Okay, thank you. This has been a really fascinating and important, actually, conversation that I hope that everybody that's listened to it will have learned a variety of things that I don't think is in the public domain generally or not well understood. So thank you for taking the time to do it. Do you have any kind of final messages or key points that you want listeners to take away?
I suppose I would always say cancer is really scary, and they do say it affects 1 in 3 of us, but most cancer is treatable now. And so we will look after you. We will get you better. Please don't be paranoid that you're going to get cancer. Just live your lives normally and we'll do our very best to treat it for you.
Thank you. And don't smoke.
And don't smoke. Don't smoke. Definitely don't smoke.
Where can we find out more about your work? You mentioned the Just Giving page or something like that. Where can we find out more?
The university has a page. If you type Andrew Beggs University, boom, to Google, my own university webpage has got a whole set of stuff about our laboratory and what we do, including videos and sort of written information about what we do. So you're very welcome to go along there and have a look. So we don't just do cancer. We do other stuff as well.
Wonderful. Thank you. So Professor Beggs, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for listening. To support this podcast, please follow us on whatever platform you're using. It makes a huge difference. Thank you again. Hope to see you next time.